think that Granny felt maybe a sense of fear that if we didn't assimilate and read and speak properly, if we didn't speak properly and read widely, that we would struggle in British society?
Yes. I mean, you have to remember that the whole purpose of her coming here, you know, was for us to have a better life and better prospects. And that meant, you know, to ensure that, she had to make sure that, you know, she influenced us. She was very deliberate in how she spoke to us. And she used to encourage us to learn a new word every day.
Okay.
You know? So your granny was a very worldly woman, but she hadn't travelled anywhere, really. She travelled the world through books. And she acquired knowledge about different cultures and different foods, different languages, different religions. And she was so knowledgeable just generally. And I think that, you know, bits of that's trickled down through all of us, really.
So in Keisha the Skit, I use a lot of slang influenced by the Caribbean, but also British culture, British vernacular of the time from a specific sort of social group.
Yeah.
But I definitely didn't learn any of that at home. I didn't hear really thick Caribbean accents at home.
Yeah.
And I definitely wasn't hearing slang words and stuff at home. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a whole different language. You wrote in a whole different language because we didn't speak like that, did we?
Yeah. But I think that's why I was so interested in it, because it was still... it still represents a part of my identity in ways.
Of course, yeah.
Mm. But yeah, I think Granny was really deliberate about us speaking properly.
Yeah.
And assimilating.
Yeah.
Mm. I wonder what... I sometimes I think I wonder, like...
what she would make of the book.
Yeah.
Well, of course, you know she'd be immensely proud.
Mm.
And although she might not be able to relate to... you know, the subject matter and stuff, she'd be immensely proud because it's a bold move, isn't it?
Yeah. I also think that she herself would probably be really surprised at the fact that this has been welcomed into the literary canon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's different. It's a reflection of the different times
that
we live in, isn't it?
Yeah. I know that organisations like the Black Curriculum are ultimately advocating for reform in the national curriculum. What do you think about the prospect of Keisha the Skit being on the national curriculum?
Oh gosh, well, I don't know what to say. I mean, I would imagine that there are lots of young women that are inspired by what you've done and how you've done it, and there'll be lots more coming up that will be able to be, you know, read everywhere and included in the curriculum. And
yeah, because I remember reading To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah,
that was the text that we had to really focus on in my final year of school, and prior to that it was Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And even though I feel like our teachers try to make it as interesting as possible and to try and show, like, these are stories of, you know, real social issues being told. So in To Kill a Mockingbird, there is the theme of racism. But we just still didn't get it or understand it.
It wasn't really relatable to our experience, was it? Because I think what growing up, there was a lot of American experiences.
Mm.
And although it was interesting, of course, we couldn't relate to it. We read To Kill a Mockingbird, so, you know, it's just the same regurgitated story, and it's crazy.
Yeah.
So it really does need a big shake-up and fresh eyes on it. And
yeah, I guess it is a signal to, like, how archaic these institutions are.
And also the language, the English language is constantly evolving.
Mm.
You know, it doesn't have to stay the same in literature, does it? That should be evolving also.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think that just the opportunity to be published, to have what I was witnessing when I was a teenager published into text and as part of the literary canon, and to do that through a publisher like Murky Books as well, I think is also a signal to change or a call to action for an archaic institution like literature to, yeah, begin changing things.
When I started secondary school and I started to gel with my friends and go to their homes, I saw a lot of differences between how I was raised and how they were raised. And people think that, you know, we're all quite similar, but actually we were very, very different. Mm. And Granny was very particular in how she wanted us to be raised. And she would ensure that we were well-read and that we didn't just focus on any one thing, that we had a broad understanding of different things and different cultures. It was really important to her. Mm. And she, you would have thought she travelled the world, but actually she travelled the world in a through books. Mm. And that's how she wanted us to be.
Do you remember the first time that you were paid for a painting?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had a bit of imposter syndrome, I'm not going to lie.
Mm.
I thought, oh gosh, you know. And sometimes, like, when I produce a piece of work, I think I like it, but no one else is going to like it. And then I'll do something and someone really likes it and I'm like not that keen on it.
Mm.
But what was it like for you? Because you just did it like completely off on a different scale.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think that I had any conception of anyone having an opinion on what I was creating when I was creating it.
Yeah. This is what I love about your generation. Mm. You just do it and nobody, you know, you're this is bothered. Me. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And so when, like, 16, 17 years later, there was this opportunity to have it published and to, yeah, like, earn from it, to monetize it, it was, I'd just never considered it ever in my life, you know. So I think it's amazing that people are able to capitalize. And I know in a similar way, your art is a depiction of us always. There's always that theme of us being within your art. And to think that people see a value in that, that they will spend money on it. Mm. I mean, of course they should, but I think it still feels like, wow,
yes.
People see value.
Yeah.
In depictions of us. Do you remember any stories, whether they were like bound in a book or maybe that you saw elsewhere in different mediums, of like a Black British or a Windrush experience?
No. Mm. Not at all. Mm. But you're talking about what, growing up?
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
I'm hard pressed to think about a book where there were any, you know, characters of colour.
Yeah.
When I was growing up. Mm. I mean, when I think about my children and in your generation, I think you're so lucky and you're so fortunate to see it everywhere. And I see it everywhere now. Didn't see it before.
Mm. You said that you love Small Island. What was it that you would say that you loved about Small Island?
It's a relatable story.
Mm.
It's so close to Granny's experience and mine a bit. That, yeah, it's refreshing to see it, because I saw it an adaptation as well as read the book. Mm. And I totally loved it, and I totally can relate to it.
Mm.
And what made you go down this the road of writing Keisha the Scare, and in the way that you wrote it?
Mm. So I think that in a similar way, it was being so enamored with the prospect of seeing yourself on the page,
okay.
You know. So I remember my first books that depicted Black life and Black experience, and it wasn't as relatable as maybe Small Island was for you to be able to see yourself and Granny, because these books that I discovered were American. So it was an American experience, but the characters were Black. And I think I just wanted to recreate that, but with British characters, yeah. Having British social experiences, but of course Black and young. And I think I was also making assumptions about what life is like as a young girl when she begins having sex and she begins being desirable. And I just think I was writing to that on the page. And I think writing it came really naturally because of the way that we were sort of socialized, to be really well acquainted with books. I feel like people always say it, but Keisha the Sket was a piece of literature that was so revolutionary almost because it had so much slang in it.
Mm.
And then the idea that that has been, accepted as part of literature now. But really, there's so many words that come from that have their roots in Caribbean sort of slang words or colloquial terms, like sket, which is sketel, which is, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, we used to use that word back in the day. It's been shortened to just sket now. We've always used words, a play on words, to communicate secretly.
Mm.
That's one of the origins of calypso.
Okay.
You know, the slaves used to sing to each other in a way so that no one could understand what was being said. Yeah, we've always played with words and language.
Mm. So I recently did a writing course, and one of the extracts that we had to read was from a Trinidadian writer, and he talks about leaving Trinidad to pursue a scholarship, and he ends up working for the BBC. And I remember in the discussion that we had as a class, and I actually brought that forward. So this writer writes, this perfect sort of sophisticated English, and talks about a character that he remembers from his boyhood in Trinidad.
Mm.
And the way that he talks about this character, it makes a little reference and suggestion sort of to this, what we're speaking about, that properness.
Yeah.
And this character being a little bit different from that. And I feel like a lot of revered sort of people from Trinidad are oftentimes writers, or they're doing things that are very well recognized by British institutions, like, they're writers or historians and things like that. Mm. I think it's very innately Trinidadian to be a particular way. Mm. When you think about Black British storytelling, what do you think are the sort of most common themes that you see in Black British storytelling?
Well, for me, it's always been around sex and crime and drugs. And but I know that there are so many different stories to tell now, because that mix of ingredients, that's tired now. Mm. Like, what else is there?
Mm.
And I'm quite sure that the audience wants to hear all the different stories that we have to tell.
Mm.
They probably don't have a clue, So, yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting, because I think that, sex, drug use and criminality, I think that they're a real human experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I do get people feeling like there's maybe an overrepresentation in storytelling that is a Black experience.
Yeah.
But I really think that it's just simply a human experience. We use drugs to escape. We use sex sometimes to escape. Crime is a means of survival. But I do think that with this sort of consciousness, because I think my generation is very conscious of that, like, what are the nuances in the stories that we would like to begin to tell?
Yeah.
And I think I see more and more us telling stories about love.
I was going to say, like, what happened to love?
Yeah. About love and healing as well. I think that we're in a real sort of healing consciousness space as a generation as well. A lot of us are in therapy, And yeah, deconstructing a lot of these ideas that we've been sort of socialized to believe.
Yeah.
And I think that that's informing a lot of our storytelling now as well. And it goes beyond sort of these survival things of escapism and survival that you see in drug use, crime, sex. Mm. Yeah.